Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it'll be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and, this afternoon, the views of our special guest, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And Dr. Cuddy, as you know, is taught at the university level. He was in the Reagan Department of Education. He certainly has written extensively, testified before Congress, certainly my favorite historian and researcher. Dr. Cuddy, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, you can get Dr. Cuddy's articles at the newswithviews.com, and you'll find the article we're going to be talking about today. And that's the one on, what is that, on politics and religion?
Yes.
All right, you go right ahead.
Well, this is a subject that is rather current because the campaign for the presidency is afoot. But at first, this article, I give an update on a previous article that I had about Javier Solana and the power elite's larger plan. Briefly, and the importance of this is that The power elite, as I mentioned before, usually uses economics as the driving force to implement their design, which is undermining national sovereignty and eventually linking regional arrangements into this world government. And because I mentioned that in the previous article, I thought it was of note that Javier Solana and a couple of recent comments that he made, one was in the Financial Times, and it was his article titled Europe and the World in 2057. In other words, he's giving this 50-year view. And as we've mentioned before, these people think far in advance. He says, quote, globalization is here to stay. It will develop from today's principally economic phenomenon to also include political, security, and cultural dimensions. Already our notion of sovereignty is changing. Regional organizations like the European Union will have an even greater role than today, end quote. Now, the reason I put that is, remember, I just said in my previous article several weeks ago about Javier Solana and the larger plan, I talk about them using economics, undermining national sovereignty, and linking regional arrangements. And lo and behold, here's Javier Solana mentioning all three of those things. Now, He wrote that on March 20th, the very next day, March 21, he speaks to the Brookings Institution up in Washington, and it's on, the topic is Managing Global Insecurity. And in there he revealed that, quote, globalization has unleashed forces that governments can neither stop nor control. I am convinced that we need stronger regional organizations, end quote. Now, notice what he said. You have no choice. It's sort of like James Warburg back in the 50s. We're going to get world government whether you like it or not. You know, whether you speak for it or against it, doesn't matter. It's going to happen. He says governments can neither stop nor control this globalization. And what's his answer? We need stronger regional organizations, end quote. So these people, I mean, if you pay attention to them, they say it, you know, right out in the open. Now, you won't hear a big deal made of it on ABC News or CBS or NBC, but they do, you know, they do tell us what they're up to. And so, you know, we can't say, well, golly, you know, nobody knew. So anyway, that's the update. And I think I hear the music, and after the break, we can pick up on the politics and religion subject for this week.
All right. I think it's so vitally important for our listeners to understand that Javier Solana is probably the single most important or powerful man in the world today, and yet most people have never heard of him. But there is an invisible force, a powerful invisible force, behind the career of this man. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who, of course, was in the Reagan White House working with, I shouldn't say the White House, but the Reagan Department of Education, has taught at university level, has testified before Congress, and he's an excellent researcher. And if you don't read his articles at newswithviews.com, why, of course, you're missing out on a great deal of education. Well, this afternoon we're going to be talking about his latest article, which is on politics and religion. So with that as a background, Dr. Cuddy, please pick the story up.
Okay. About the Reagan White House, I did get there, and I got around quite a bit, although the main effort was in the Department of Education. I would find myself getting invited over there and, you know, given some award or whatever, because I was doing other things. The Justice Department, for example, asked me to testify on their behalf before Congress on the issue of school busing and so on. So I did wind up over there, although my main place was in the Department of Ed. On the topic this week, politics and religion, the current presidential campaign is interesting to me for a number of reasons, but in this particular subject about politics and religion, the candidates' religious values seem to be a major topic of discussion. You'll hear them talking about their faith and so on. Now, that's a little different because in the past it seemed that only Republicans wanted to talk about their beliefs and how their faith affected their views and their political decisions. But now, in the current campaign, you'll find the Democrats. You'll find Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and all of them talking about their religious values. There is a difference, though. What happens is they seem very willing to talk about these issues in general terms, you know, like, I think we should help the poor, you know, something like that. But when you start to get down to specifics, they all of a sudden become very agitated. For example, if you would ask Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, why do you believe that Jesus, they claim to be Christians, why do you believe that Jesus would approve of women violently killing their preborn children by abortion, which you support? I mean, why? Can you point to something, Senator Clinton, in the Bible where Jesus is giving any hint, you know, that he would think this is a good thing? They don't like that.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Dr. Cuddy is simply pointing out that the Democratic candidates are making quite an issue now of their deep and abiding religious beliefs and how religion has influenced their thoughts. But when you try to pin them down, and Dr. Cuddy used the example of Sidney asking Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton, where in the Bible she could find any justification for a mother killing her unborn child. Why, of course, Hillary doesn't want to talk about that. She wants to talk in glowing and general terms about her religious belief because I believe that the candidates in both the Republicans and the Democratic Party are using religion. And, of course, all you need to do is see what they do in their private lives. All you need to do is see how they vote. And you realize, of course, that they really don't believe in the tenets of Jesus Christ. But, you know, Christianity is a pretty good commodity, good for a lot of votes. So pick the story up there.
You're right. It affects Republicans as well. Rudy Giuliani is also, quote, pro-choice, even though he claims to be a Catholic, and the Catholic faith says abortion is wrong. And Mitt Romney as well got very agitated. There's this little clip on TV where some reporter isn't just, you know, how does your faith energize you? Oh, yes, you know, I believe in helping the poor, doing good works, and so on. But he actually starts to get rather specific about certain Mormon beliefs, and all of a sudden Mitt Romney gets, you know, a little agitated at that. So in general terms, they're perfectly willing, you know, to speak about their faith. But when you start to get down into specifics, they back off a little. Now, that, to me, seems problematic because one's specific religious beliefs and how they are politically influenced by those beliefs seems to me of extremely critical importance. I use an example in my article. There's a cartoonist, there's a national cartoonist called Benson, And some years ago, he had a cartoon. It shows Abraham Lincoln, you know, with his stovepipe hat on, and he's at a podium, and he's delivering a speech to a crowd. And he says, quote, "Personally, I'm against slavery, but hey, if you want to own one, that's your business," end quote. And the whole point Benson was making in this issue was he was illustrating the hypocrisy of candidates who say they're personally opposed to abortion, but then they say they can't take any political action to end that that violent killing because that would be imposing their religious belief on others. Well, I call them hypocrites because they would vote to, quote, impose their views, quote, against slavery in a heartbeat. You know, if the issue was slavery, oh, yes, I'll vote, you know, let's pass a law against slavery. And that's fine. I mean, that's good. But it is hypocritical for them to have that type of attitude. But then when it comes to an issue, let's say like abortion, oh, no, you know, I can't do that. Or some similar issue about sex ed in the schools or whatever it is. So anyway, I think it's entirely appropriate for political candidates and all Americans to have their religious views influence their political decisions. Now, if you go back to the founders of the country, President John Adams, this is way back, 1798, he's second president, on October 11th, here's what he says, quote, "Our Constitution is made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly," that's W-H-O-L-L-Y, "wholly inadequate to the government of any other," end quote. And that was the prevailing view. It was the sentiment for, you know, decades after that, because you find there's this North Carolina senator, he was a U.S. senator from North Carolina, his name was George Badger. And on January 19th of 1853, his report of the U.S. Senate on the founders' intent of the religion clauses of the First Amendment, it was adopted by the U.S. Senate, and it stated, and this is sort of long, but I'm going to read it, quote, "Our fathers," that means the founding fathers, "were true lovers of liberty and utterly opposed any constraint upon the rights of conscience. They intended, by this amendment," this First Amendment, "to prohibit an establishment of religion such as the English Church presented or anything like it, but they had no fear or jealousy of religion itself. Nor did they wish to see us an irreligious people. They did not intend to prohibit a just expression of religious devotion by the legislators of the nation, even in their character as legislators. They did not intend to send our armies and navies forth to do battle for our country without any national recognition of that God on whom success or failure depends. They did not intend to spread over all the public authorities and the whole public action of the nation the dead and revolting spectacle of atheistical apathy. Not so had the battles of the Revolution been fought and the deliberations of the Revolutionary Congress been conducted. On the contrary, all had been done with a continual appeal to the supreme ruler of the world and an habitual reliance upon his protection and of the righteous cause which they commended to his care," end quote. So it's very clear that the first of the founding of the nation, and for decades after, the understanding of members of Congress was that your religious views were extremely important, and yes, you could talk about them, and yes, they could influence specific legislation.
No, I think it's really so important that people understand the relationship between America and religion. And, of course, America was a unique nation because we limited the power of the federal government over the lives of the people. And, of course, our founders realized that you could only have a limited government if you had moral people. If you had immoral people and you had limited government, you'd have chaos and anarchy. And somebody once said it's either going to have to be the Bible or the bullet. It's going to have to be, we're going to have a moral people or we're going to have a tyranny. And you could only limit the power of government with a moral people. And morality is based upon religion. I don't care what anybody wants to say. Oh, I'm perfectly moral and I have no religion at all. I don't believe in the Bible. Well, then, of course, you don't believe in the Bible. You're answerable to yourself. And you become God, and of course, whatever you want to do, and that is the way it was in any tyrant. Man is basically corrupt. The only thing that makes him able to live in a civilized society is a belief in a superior being who will direct his course of action, and who he is answerable to. And of course, the founding fathers recognized that people had to believe that one day we would all stand before the bar of judgment to be judged for what we do here on this earth. And what they wanted were people who had a fear of God. There is where the freedom comes from. People who fear God can be free, and people who don't fear God, well, of course, they will, of course, participate in all sorts of excesses and create a terrible problem. So go right ahead, Dennis.
Okay. What you said reminded me of something. I don't have it right in front of me, but as I recall, there was a problem in the 1790s with this sort of incipient notion that our Declaration of Independence was, you know, that really wasn't the government, it was the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't mention, you know, Jesus, and so it's very secular. And this sort of, you know, is starting to float around. And I remember an address by George Washington, I forget the exact date, and he's going on, and he's making a big point about the distinction between morals and religion. And he was saying, basically what he said was, no, it's not just some sort of general morality consensus. He says, what you need is, are specific references to God, to religion, to faith. And I think the term he used was those of peculiar mind, he called them, that think you can distinguish between the two. He said, no, you really need these religious values. You know, there is a difference. And a meaningful difference between people with religion, say Judeo-Christian values, and those who have this sort of humanistic, moral, you know, I want to be nice to everybody attitude. Okay, back to the article. A few years after that Senate report, which was in 1853, a few years after that was adopted, Americans ended slavery with the 13th Amendment, and that was largely due, you'll find if you look back to the abolitionist movement, largely led by people with those strong religious views. Similarly, religious people would later, after that, in the late 1800s, be responsible for making amends to the American Indians for promises our government broke to them. You may recall, you know, the Trail of Tears with the Cherokees, you know, just shoo on out here to Oklahoma, and, you know, I know it's difficult, but don't worry, all land west of the Mississippi will be given to you, quote, in perpetuity. You know, our government was saying things like that and then reneging on it. So anyway, it was largely the efforts of religious people to sort of right that injustice. And then, of course, in the 20th century, it was largely religious people who were at the forefront of the effort to end discrimination against racial minorities. And so people of faith and strong religious opinions and views actually pursued through the legislative bodies a political action which is entirely legitimate. However, today, since the 60s and when you had individuals, you know, leading the movement to have racial discrimination ended, for example, what you find is, unfortunately, it seems to be across the board almost, there seems to be far less effort on the part of Americans in general to see that their religious values do impact the political decisions they make and the people they elect make. It's the consensus, for example, among historians, that if President John F. Kennedy's illicit sexual escapades had been revealed, he would not have been elected. Now, you know, Ben Bradley and the Washington Post, a lot of those guys knew about that stuff, but they deliberately kept it out of the press, the major press, because they knew that if the general public of America had known about his hanky-panky with Marilyn Monroe and all these others, he would not have been elected. It was a relatively close election, and he wouldn't have been elected.
And I think it's so interesting that even after he was assassinated, it was 6 or 8 years before anybody would write a book and tell the truth. They had the information, and they just suppressed it. And if they can suppress that information about John Kennedy, what other things are they suppressing from the American people that we're not intelligent enough to know about? Well, we'll be back here in just a moment. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and I think his point is quite well taken, that certainly everybody, you know, who knew anything about Jack Kennedy knew he made an alley cat's morals look far better than his. And when he was in the White House, he had all sorts of affairs, but it was always protected by the controlled media. Go right ahead, Dr. Cuddy.
Yes, as you said, it was. Actually, it's really a rather despicable past, because I remember way back, and when he was a young fellow, his father, they used to call it, the point being, my father was from Massachusetts, and the attitude of old, they called him old Joe Kennedy, was he used to brag about it. I mean, he did it too, and he used to challenge his sons, you know, it was sort of like a contest or something, and so that's the attitude they grew up with. It's, you know, it's very similar among them. So anyway, the point that I'm trying to make here is that there was, at that time, in the early 60s, an attitude on the part of most Americans that you really should have strong religious beliefs, and they should impact how you viewed politicians and the decisions they made. And that's why they kept, one reason they kept JFK's activities and affairs out of the public eye in the major press. However, in the 90s, if you were to go around in the 90s and ask people who voted for Bill Clinton, even though his sexual, extramarital sexual activities were widely known, I mean widely known, ask those who voted for Bill Clinton, well, are you a Christian? Oh, yeah, I'm a Christian. Many of them would say that. So apparently there was this big shift in thinking on the part of the general public. Their psychology, whatever you want to call it, morality, had changed in the 60s. If you had done what Kennedy did and they knew about it, no, we're not going to elect you. In the 90s, completely different. Millions of people claiming to be Christians had no problem voting for Bill Clinton. So, and that's just not, I don't mean to pick specifically or only on Clinton. Many so-called Christians also re-elected members of Congress who supported most favored nation status for communist China, even though that nation's widespread persecution of Christians was widely recognized. I mean, why would you do that? Here's a member of Congress. They take a poll, something like 80% are against NAFTA and GATT and most favored nation status for China. They go in and vote for it anyway, and then you reelect them. Even though you know, I mean, it's in the news all over the place, yes, the communist Chinese are persecuting Christians. Yes, they're going into house churches and throwing them in jail. Oh, that's okay with me. Let's do some business with them. I mean, that is a completely different attitude from 40 or 50 years ago on the part of the American public. The free trade agreements, so-called free trade agreements, the same people support those free trade agreements, when actually there's all kinds of evidence, not only that it hurts the U.S., because it's not really free trade, it's managed trade. It's not, I mean, free trade is everybody trades with everybody and there's no restrictions, but actually, without getting into that in any depth, other governments subsidize their industries and there's unfair competition and so forth and so on. But the point is, these so-called free trade agreements not only hurt us, that they often hurt the poor people in other countries. There was this recent report by an organization, I don't agree with all they do, but Oxfam International. What they found is that the so-called free trade agreements, quote, victimized the poor while benefiting the wealthy. That's the, you know, in multinational corporation types. Nevertheless, they trend toward regional agreements. There's that word again. Regional agreements and globalization continues. In an increasingly globalized world, these agreements seek to benefit rich country exporters and firms at the expense of poor farmers and workers, end quote. The report goes on, and let me digress for a minute there. I'll give a specific example. I don't know whether I've told this audience or not, but a woman I know, her daughter's just completed this MBA program. And the daughter called her, and she was over in China.
Hold that thought. We're going to be right back here in just a moment with Dr. Cuddy. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Dr. Cuddy is pointing out that certainly, you know, the immorality of John Kennedy would have, you know, if it had been known, he never would have been elected president. But when it got around to Bill Clinton and his escapades, a lot of Christians just didn't seem to be too concerned. And then Dr. Cuddy carries this over into our discussion of, well, what about trade with communist China? I mean, here's a country that kills people, has kills the first child. You only have one child, and certainly they persecute Christians. They throw them in prison, and lots of times they'll execute them and sell their organs. And a totally immoral country, and yet, of course, the average American, the average Christian, is voting for politicians who voted to give for the most favored nation treaties of status and all sorts of benefits to communist China. And, of course, How can a Christian support a politician who would do that sort of thing? So pick the story up there, Dennis.
Right. How can they support the politicians, and how can they actually participate personally in this? The incident I was given just before the break is, it's not in my article, but a friend of mine, her daughter, just completed an MBA, Master's of Business Administration program. And one day her daughter calls her from China in Shanghai. The MBA program had taken a tour over there, you know, business, international business. And she said, Mom, she said, you wouldn't believe this place. And she said, I got a picture here of a skyscraper, and right in front of it are these two women, and they're on the lawn cutting grass with scissors. Where do they live? She said, if you look right next to that building, there's a little shanty. And that's where all these people live. They live in these shanties between these huge, beautiful skyscrapers that the press and media show you of how much China's advancing. She said, then, Mom, she said, we took a trip to a factory, and I'm not going to, I'll mention Carter Baby Clothes. There were others, you know, other businesses, American-named businesses, but Carter Baby Clothes, they're all over the place, big name and baby clothes. She said, Mom, I walked into that place, she said, and it reeked of urine all over the place. And we asked, you know, why is this? They said, well, the people only given a little bit of time in the middle of the day to eat lunch, otherwise they cannot go to the bathroom. There are no bathroom facilities. They got to do it right there. Now, that type of stuff is what Americans are supporting. That's not just the politicians. That's average Americans. When they go out and buy products X, Y, and Z, you know, whether it's electronics or whatever, that's what they're supporting. And if you ask these Americans, are you a Christian? Oh, yes, I'm a good Christian. There's an entirely different mindset from what it used to be years ago. Back to the article. This report by Oxfam said that NAFTA, for example, has brought 1.3 million job losses to Mexico in 10 years. It's not just hurting us. It's supposed to, you know, have benefited both countries. Oftentimes people say, well, you know, it's bad for the U.S., which it is. It is bad. But what is rarely mentioned are the specifics of how it's also bad for Mexico. So it's cost 1.3 million job losses to Mexico in 10 years, and some studies show that Mexico's real wages in 2004 were less than in 1994. So this great benefit that was going to come about to Mexico by NAFTA, According to a WorldNet Daily column recently, just March 31st, a few months ago, quote, other studies have explained how cheap agricultural products, imports, from U.S. agribusiness, see, they're wiping out the small farmer, U.S. agribusiness concerns have made it nearly impossible for small farmers in China to, I mean, in Mexico to compete. Many reportedly have been forced from their land and become illegal migrant workers in the U.S., end quote. And my final statement, that paragraph is, might this have been the power elite's intention all along? In other words, this big migrant problem we've got here, where are they coming from? Oftentimes, you know, they have experience, right? They were the small farmers in Mexico who have been driven off their land because of NAFTA.
And it's because, of course, we're sending subsidized corn. We pay our farmers, subsidize our farmers, and then they can undercut the Mexican farmers. And then, of course, these people destitute, desperate for work, desperate to be able to feed their families, come to the United States where they can get free health care and free education and free housing and make a very, very good wage, at least, of course, as far as Mexicans, of course, they're much lower than here. And that in the process, of course, then they drive the wages in the United States down, and people in taking unskilled jobs or jobs in construction or meat packing or many of those things. Now their wages have just tumbled to two-thirds to half, and of course they're going a great deal lower. And Dr. Cuddy is asking the question, is this what they really intended all along? We're going to be back here in just a moment to explore this idea of politics and religion. And most of our listeners are Christians, and are you concerned about what's really going on, or that our policies are bringing poverty to people all throughout the world today? Well, this is Dr. Stan. Good, Cuddy, you go right ahead, pick up the story.
Okay. The question, I guess, each person, whether they're listening here or, you know, if you talk to somebody else, should be asking themselves is, what is it about your faith, your biblical faith, that allows you to support this stuff? You know, I mean, that allows you to support NAFTA or to support buying, you know, baby clothes when they're produced by almost slave labor. How can you do that? I think in the last program I said there was somebody sort of debating me about Harry Potter. And I said, look, you know, let's forget all about this, you know, whether you're going to become a witch if you read the book or whatever. I said, what would Jesus tell you? I mean, if Jesus was standing right here, it's not so much what would Jesus do. Jesus is God. There's this little thing, you know, what would Jesus do? I think it's better to say, what would Jesus say? I mean, you know, God can do anything. So it's not a question of do. We can't compare what we can do to what God can do. But what would Jesus say about your reading whatever it is, a Harry Potter, or watching some immoral soap opera on TV? Or what would Jesus say about your support, you know, of a manufacturer that uses Chinese slave labor? I mean, what would Jesus say about that? And if Jesus wouldn't say, yes, fine with me, then why are you doing it? Why are you doing this? But a lot of preachers, for some reason, apparently they're not, you know, preaching this message in the church. So anyway, back with the article, many, as I say in my article, many so-called American Christians were practically silent in 2001 when our federal government was giving over $100 million to the radical Muslim Taliban in Afghanistan. Remember, it's 2001. At that time, you know, 9/11, let's say, before September hadn't happened, but still we knew that the Taliban was harboring Osama bin Laden, and we knew, even then, that he was responsible for killing Americans in the USS Cole, in Africa, you know, Kenya and so forth, Tanzania, and the World Trade Center bombing in 93. So we knew that. I mean, that was even in the New York Times, you know, Al-Qaeda, 1993 bombing, okay. So why are we giving $100 million to the Taliban when they're harboring our, quote, you know, enemy number one? Why are we doing that? So it had become, quote, religiously and politically incorrect, if you think about the period, to speak out against radical Muslims, you know, still today even. Why is this? Well, there was this not only inside the U.S., but in general, there had been this growing attitude for about 20 years, ever since, I give a specific example, November 25, 1981. What happened then? The U.N. General Assembly adopted this is the formal title, the Declaration on Elimination of All Forms of Intolerance and Discrimination Based on Religion or Belief.
Hold up now, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Cuddy was simply pointing out that certainly in the year 2001, this was prior to the attack on the World Trade Center, the United States gave the Taliban about $100 million. And of course, you can want to check that out. You can read George Bush's speech to the nation on the 20th of October, pardon me, the 20th of September, just 9 days after the attack. And there he talks about how we'd given some $27 million in humanitarian aid to Afghanistan, which was the Taliban. So, and then, of course, we gave a lot of other money, about probably $100 million that year, to the Taliban, who were harboring Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, who it was well known had been responsible for the bombing of the Cole and the bombing of the American embassies in both Tanzania and Kenya. So why were we financing the Taliban, who were harboring and giving, of course, support to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, when they were our enemies? That really doesn't make sense. And go ahead and pick up on that story, Dr. Cuddy.
Okay, well, the attitude then had shifted, not only here, but internationally, gave the U.N. General Assembly adopting this declaration in 1981.
And what was that declaration for?
Well, the formal title is Declaration on Elimination of All Forms of Intolerance and Discrimination Based on Religion or Belief. So, in other words, you were supposed to separate any, you know, it's like the communist Chinese. Whenever we start to criticize them, they say, well, let's keep economics separate from, you know, values. And it's totally different, they say. Apparently, we've adopted that, you know. Our government policies are to have nothing to do with morality at all, apparently. And apparently, a lot of Americans, politicians and American citizens have bought that for some reason. I don't know why. But anyway, that was November 25 of 1981. The UN General Assembly adopted that. Well, more recently, you find that there's this sort of, you know, one faith is as good as another. You know, who cares? On February 2 of this year, Democrats, there's a lot of Democrats, leading Democrats, with heads bowed, were led in prayer by a Muslim imam. Now, a lot of them were Christians. And here they are, bowing their head in prayer, led by a Muslim imam. On July 12th, in the Democrat-controlled U.S. Senate, the session was opened by Rajan Zed, a Hindu religious leader. So, you know, apparently it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter if you believe in God, you know, the God of the Bible. It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter.
But it does matter because it's a different God. The Muslim
right.
God is not the God we worship. The Hindu God is not the God we worship. Why would any Christian bow the head and worship at the same time?
That's exactly right. And this was the open, you know, how they have an opening prayer. You know, it's a Methodist, Baptist, Catholic, rabbi, whatever. In this case, a Hindu religious leader opened the session on July 12th of the U.S. Senate, which was Democrat-controlled. Now, those people, those religious people in the U.S. who, over the past 20 or so years, most often speaking out on political issues, have been what we generally know as fundamentalists, evangelical fundamentalists. Well, they've now been branded, quote, enemies by church growth leader Rick Warren. Now, that might surprise all of you. Listen, what? Rick Warren? No, international, leading the efforts to feed the poor, church growth, and, you know, he claims to be a Christian. How? Why would he be branding fundamentalists as enemies? I don't believe. Well, I give the citation. It's in the Philadelphia Inquirer, January 8th of last year. He's quoted as saying this. He's quoted as actually predicting that fundamentalism of all varieties will be, quote, one of the big enemies of the 21st century, Muslim fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, Jewish fundamentalism, secular fundamentalism. They're all motivated by fear of each other, end quote. That's Rick Warren's view.
And incidentally, there's a series of programs on CNN that's been the last couple of nights about God's warriors. And, of course, they've done the Jews, they've done a piece on the Christians, they're going to do a piece on the Muslims. All of these fundamentalists, they're the real enemy. And God's warriors on CNN, people need to look that up and understand Christianity is under attack today, and not only from without, but from within.
Right. Now, the reason I mentioned, you know, it's not just Christian fundamentalism, it's a Jewish fundamentalism and so forth. Remember, I think in the previous program with this audience, I mentioned how this Delphi technique is branding fundamentalists, whatever they are, religious fundamentalists, as uncompromising. You know, we need to compromise, we need to cooperate, we need to work together for world peace. A lot of the wars in the past have been caused by religious views, you know the mantra that they give. But that's one of the reasons that they're doing this now. They're trying to brand anybody with orthodox religious views, you know, moral absolutes, as somehow responsible for all of the problems of the world, and therefore we should, you know, demonize them and not pay attention to them, and only those others, the moderates, who get along with everybody, who share the same views, you know, that's who should lead the world. And so what I do is I look back at where the evangelical and fundamentalist Christians first flexed their national political muscles. They had been involved in a number of issues. But what you found was that primarily in the 1980 campaign, you found a lot of people who had been disappointed with Jimmy Carter, and they all of a sudden rallied. There were a lot of Democrats, you call them Reagan Democrats, because of their religious views. They supported the election of Ronald Reagan. But what a lot of people don't know is that Ronald Reagan, who, you know, I was there during the administration, and there were a lot of good things done. But it was Ronald Reagan who proceeded to call for a, quote, new world order, end quote, and referred to, quote, points of light. Now, he was the first president. Most people think that was George H.W. Bush who first used those terms. And it was George H.W. Bush who used the term points of light linked to service, which was the old Alice Bailey usage, and Alice Bailey also used new world order. But Reagan was the first president who used both terms, new world order and, quote, points of light. Now, I give the specific quotes, and then I'll tell you why I'm doing this, because there's a reason. What happened was, in his October 12, 1982 state dinner toast, it was a toast, President Reagan pronounced that, quote, all nations, big or small, strong or weak, should strive together, motivated by the firm determination to build a new world order which guarantees political justice, economic justice, and social justice, end quote. Then a little bit later, 3 years later, the Conference on Religious Liberty, April 16th, 1985, he declared that, quote, throughout the world, the machinery of the state is being used as never before against religious freedom. At the same time, throughout the world, new groups of believers keep springing up, points of light flash out in the darkness, and so forth, end quote. Now, note the word he uses, world, and is followed by new groups. And, you know, without getting into a long, you know, psychoanalysis here, try and remember if you've ever heard those words together, world and new groups. Now, why am I saying this? Oftentimes, presidents don't write their own speeches. In this case, that speech, Reagan's speech, was written by Peggy Noonan. She was the same one who wrote President Bush's famous 1988 reference to, quote, points of light. And what I thought was strange about it is, regarding where she said she got that term for President Bush's speech, she wrote a book, you know, shortly thereafter. It was called What I Saw at the Revolution. It was printed in 1990, published then. Now, this was her explanation of where she got this, you know, it was all over the press, points of light, so on. And so she's explaining in her book, you know, where could I have gotten that term from? She says, quote, is it possible it was on file in my unconscious and bubbled up when I needed the right phrase, question mark? Then she says, yes, end quote. Well, now remember, that's rather curious, given that 3 years before, in a speech for Reagan, she had used the same term.
I know, because I think people, for our listeners out there, have to know where the term came from. It came from a being called Joie Cool, who actually channeled through a woman named Alice Bailey, certainly the leading occultist of the first half of the last century, at least 19 books. And that term actually was written by, or channeled through Alice Bailey, the points of light, and of course the term New World Order. And since I read occult literature, I can remember reading in occult literature, one of the occultists is saying, gee, this is the first time I've ever seen that term used outside the occult, and it's being used by George Bush, the President of the United States.
Right, and the only reason I brought that up, like I said, is a lot of people have that conception that he was the first one. Actually, it was President Reagan, but it was actually both speeches were written by Peggy Noonan, who I think is worth keeping an eye on. Now, the term, the New World Order, that the power elite has planned for us includes, among other things, monitoring all our activities, you know, sort of the Big Brother syndrome. And when I say monitoring all our activities, I mean even whether you go to church. And I give a specific example from the London Daily Mail just a couple of months ago, June 27, 2006. The title of the article is Big Brother Database to Record the Lives of All Children. And in this article, it indicates that, quote, the home life of every child in the country, every child, is to be recorded on a national database. Computer records holding details of school performance, diet, and even whether their parents provide a positive role model, you know, according to the state, I guess, will be held by the government. The Children's Index, that's what it's called, will even monitor whether youngsters are getting five portions of fruits and vegetables a day, you know, not four portions, five, and whether they go to church, end quote. So they're going to be monitoring everything.
Well, of course, they do that right now. One of the reasons for the grocery cards, if you have a Safeway grocery card or another grocery card, everything you buy, you're getting a discount. You think that's really great. But everything you buy goes into a computer and into permanent files that certainly are being disseminated not only to the corporations but are readily available to the government. Every time you go to the doctor today, they ask you to sign this privacy form. You've got to sign this privacy form. You want to go to the dentist, you got to sign the privacy form. Look and see what it really says. It takes away all your privacy. Understand, they say one thing, and most people are so gullible, they think that they're looking after your privacy. No, that information's all going and it will eventually be on your personal dossier. They are collecting dossiers on everyone in America. If you doubt that, that wonderful book by certainly one of our former director of the National Security Agency, Lieutenant General Odom, and his book Fixing Intelligence says, you know, are they, he can't tell you what we're doing because he was the head of the NSA, the top secret, you know, organization in America. NSA, no such agency, 100,000 employees. I mean, you think the CIA is watching you? NSA is the one who's really doing it. And he can't tell you what he's doing, but he's a patriot. And he says, should the government be collecting dossiers on American citizens? You know, that's the only way he can tell us what they're really doing.
Right, and you know, it's they should title it a lack of privacy form rather than the privacy form, but then that would fit, you know, with Orwell's newspeak, as they called it. War is peace, freedom is slavery. You know, it's actually the opposite of what it is. And yeah, they don't just collect it, you know, well, here it is, and it's in some deep file somewhere. They actually use it. For example, if you go to, if your listeners go to the grocery store and they have one of these store cards, you know, whatever the store is, and you know, like you said, you scan, look at this, you get a great bargain here, it's so much off. Well, they probably jack the price up, and then they're really lowering it to the same level.
Yeah, they triple the price, and then they cut it in half when you use your card. And it costs you really more to use the card than if you went to a store that didn't have them. But.
Right, but they, also what happens is they say, oh, and if you sign up for this, like, email, what we'll do, you know, and you sign up for this, and we'll give you, like, this little bonus. You know, if your name goes in this pot here, every week we'll choose a person from the pot, and we'll give them $100. And why are you signing up your email? Well, because we will, I'm not making this up, this really happens. What we'll do is by email, we'll let you know what things are going on sale, which are the things that you have bought. In other words, every Monday, let's say, you go to your computer and you log on, right? And there's, you know, the blank store is specials. And what they've done is they've looked at everything you bought. And so when peaches, let's say you buy peaches, peaches are on sale, that'll flash up. We want to let you know. Aren't we wonderful? We're letting you know before you get to the store that peaches, which you buy, are on sale this week. See how nice we are to you. So they are using this stuff and keeping track of what you eat and so on. Okay, so anyway, in the U.S., I mentioned Big Brother. Now they'll have the ability to proclaim a dictatorship with ease. And I'll mention the specifics and the reason why. President Bush, on May 9th of this year, 2007, signed what was called two things, the National Security Presidential Directive 51, and Homeland Security Presidential Directive 20. Now, what he is able to do, unlike previous presidents, what these two things allow him to do is to he doesn't have to issue, you can just call an emergency, he doesn't even have to issue an emergency proclamation which describes the emergency. In other words, he has to justify it. He can't just say there's an emergency. He has to say an emergency because, you know, A, B, C have happened. And he doesn't even have to consult with Congress. That's the difference. Prior to this, he had to, you know, the president could have these executive orders and whatever, or presidential decision directives, and he'd, you know, consult with Congress or whatever. But now he can simply declare an emergency and take over all executive functions. You know, you think this applies just to the executive branch of the federal government? No. These executive orders allow him to take over all executive functions, the state level, the county level, the local level, even down to the tribal level. You know, he's not even going to leave Indians alone. He assumes all executive functions. That's different from previous presidential directives or decision directives. Now, one of Dr. Sands and my friends, John Leffler, has a program, Steel on Steel, and he was relevant to this, interviewing Dr. Jerome Corsi. And they asked Dr. Corsi, he asked, why is President Bush wanting these powers now? I mean, after all, you know, you can sort of understand it. You don't like it, but after 9/11, right, 2001, why is he waiting like 6 years? Why 6 years after 9/11 is he asking for this authority, these two presidential directives, at this time? It's at the end of his presidency. You know, what's going on? I mean, does he know something we don't know? is why is he making this tremendous power grab at this particular time late in his presidency? On that same radio program, Dr. Corsi asked why Americans correctly believe it's wrong to have blacks as slaves in the U.S., but then think it's acceptable to buy products produced by what amounts to Chinese slaves in communist China. In other words, it was the same thing I was asking earlier in this article. Why is it, if you ask Americans, hey, do you want a black slave? No, this is outrageous, you know, freedom, freedom. Well, then why are you buying products made by Chinese slaves in communist China? Try that sometime. Try asking the person you come in contact with. I hear the music.
You hear the music, and Chris's guest has been Dr. Dennis Cuddy. You'll find his articles at newswithviews.com. That's newswithviews.com. And, of course, we do carry his books and his material. You can get one of our catalogs, look them up, and we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up our program this afternoon. Well, Dennis, you want to go ahead, and you have 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay. Well, I'll just use the 3 minutes to reiterate the main points. Number one, in the update, the exact terms I had used about using economics, undermining sovereignty, regional arrangements, we now have quotes by Javier Solana himself saying those same things. 2 days right in a row, March 20, March 21. This exact same thing. In terms of the main thrust of the article, religion and politics, what is important is that at the founding of the nation, they were inexorably linked. President Washington made a distinction between just sort of moral, general beliefs and behavior and your actual action that you take as an individual American and as a politician and how it influences how you vote and for political office. Then we said there's a distinction, and you might think about this. Why, ask yourself, why is it 50 years ago we were a very, very moral country and holding to very high standards our politicians, so much so that a president would not have been elected if the public had known about his sexual escapades, but just 30 years later in the 1990s, millions of, I call them so-called Christians, have no problem voting for a candidate for the presidency who did the same thing as JFK did. Not only that, it's not just a matter of who you vote for. Think of your own personal actions. Why is it, as Jerome Corsi said, do you think it's a horrible thing to have blacks as slaves, and it is, but for some reason you're willing to support slavery in other countries by your purchasing power, going along with, and I gave the specific examples of how people in other countries are treated horribly. I use communist China. They're not the only one. I mean, the other, you know, youngsters, it's almost like we have child protection laws and child labor laws, you know, 100 years ago in this country. Other countries don't. I mean, they're using these children, you know, just like we did 100 years ago, these sweatshops. And apparently now Americans don't have any big problem with that. I'm not talking about politicians. I'm talking about the typical American consumer will literally go out to a store and buy these things knowing perfectly well what the conditions they're produced under, and apparently has no problem with that. There's a disconnect. There's a disconnect that all of your listeners really ought to think about, and when they talk to others, talk to them about it. How come we have this disconnect? Back then, 30, 40 years ago, there was a direct relationship between the actions we as individuals took and the people we elected to office and what standards we held them to. Now, there is a disconnect there. Then there wasn't. Now there is. For some reason, there is no application of our moral values and religious beliefs to how we as individuals should act and the politicians that we support.
Well, thank you. We're out of time. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Cuddy. We try to have him on here at least once a week, and we're going to have him on in this time slot so you can be sure to hear him. Now, I would point out that we carry a number of Dennis Cuddy's books here, and you can get a list of them if you'd like to by calling us. But there's one book that we really need to get back in print. It's called Secret Records Revealed. We need to get this book back in print, and we've got about a third of the pledges that we need to do it. We put this to one side because of other presses, other issues, but right now we're going to ask again. If you'd like to get a case of Dr. Keddie's books, and you'd be getting, I think, 30 books for $149.95, it is an excellent book. It's about 300 pages. It has an index. It has, you know, all sorts of information there that you need to know. And, Chris, the price will be low. We will not bill you until we're ready to go ahead with printing. But if you'd be interested in helping us and helping Dr. Keddie, and, of course, we have to give him a commission on his books, which we will get. But if you pledge $149.95, you'll get a case of his books as soon as they are printed. You'll have to pay the mailing on that, probably about $15. But it's important we get this book out. It's one of the most important books I have in my library, Secret Records Revealed. And we'd like to get all of Dr. Keddie's books back in print. So if you're interested in going along with us, give us a call at 1-888-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. As they say, we'll not bill you until we're ready to go to print. If we've got about a third of the people we need, and if we can just get a few more, Paul Walters of News with Views will go into this with us. So we hope that some of you out there will be in a position to help. That's a case of Dr. Keddie's books, $149.95. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which explains the spiritual component which has influenced the outlook of Americans and why we're really not concerned about the moral absolutes we used to be. Because there are powerful spiritual forces in the world today. And you can either get the Brotherhood of Darkness book or DVD or VHS or even the audio tape of that. And then, of course, we have our next talk. It's called The Forbidden Secret. And it will tell you the secret that has been passed down for 5,000 years through the secret societies. It has been known to most of the great world leaders. And it's the same secret that, of course, that Rhonda Burns talks about in her book, The Secret, that sold some 5,000 copies, except that, of course, she doesn't tell you what it's really about. And, of course, that originates with these secret societies that have always been here. And, of course, so that's The Forbidden Secret. There's a syllabus that goes with that, which you'll really want to get. And then, of course, you'll want to get The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, an award-winning DVD. It's about almost 2 1/4 hours, 2 1/3 hours. And it takes you into the secret societies that were here at the time America was created. It takes you to Elizabethan England in the 1600s and how these ideas spread from England to America. And then the next film in this series is called Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And you cannot understand why we're really in Iraq, and why, when the military is saying, we've got to get our troops out of there, we've got to bring them home, the surge is not working, the president says, oh no, we're going to stay there, and we're going to bring democracy to Iraq. And if we were to pull out now, there'd be chaos. Well, there's got to be chaos whether we stay or whether we come home. Why are we fighting there? You have to see Riddles in Stone. And then, of course, there's a book we carry called The Secret Destiny of America, and of course it's not on a regular list, but you can get it, and when you read that along with the DVD Riddles in Stone, you will know more than most university professors about what's really going on. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5, because America, 5-HIV-WAR,